From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Legislative leaders say they'll use reserve funds to pay workers after a surprise veto by the governor.
Let's just say there's no way he couldn't know what these vetoes would do.
Also this week, holy bipartisanship. New services for Florida's military veterans bring near universal applause.
It's going to be well received by our veterans and every other citizen in our great state.
We'll also find that several new Florida laws are now on hold after being taken to court, and we'll get the status of that controversial constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right to an abortion in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida's $116.5 billion spending plan for the new fiscal year goes into effect July 1st. It's smaller than the budget approved by state lawmakers after Governor Ron DeSantis made almost $1 billion worth of vetoes. $56 million worth of cuts were made to legislative support services, as Gina Jordan reports.
The veto wiped out funding for joint legislative committees and an array of services. Those include the Office of Economic and Demographic Research, the Old Capitol Museum, and the Florida Channel, which is produced and operated by WFSU-TV. The cut came just a few weeks before the new fiscal year, potentially putting a lot of legislative employees quickly out of a job. That is, until they got a memo saying House and Senate leadership will tap rainy day reserve money to keep offices open and staffed. Dara Kam wrote about this surprising veto for our partner, the News Service of Florida. She's a senior writer and host of the Deeper Dive with Dara Kam podcast. She's covered state government for more than 25 years.
You wrote that these cuts would impact about 200 jobs. So did the governor mean to do this?
Well, the governor did mean to do it based on something he said the other day. What happened was we have budget fine print called proviso language. The money for the legislative support services included proviso language that would have steered an unidentified amount of money to a study about doing away with the fees credit card companies can impose on sales taxes. Credit card companies were opposed to that study. So that was included in those line items. And so they got vetoed. And he said that that was what he was aiming at with the veto. And he also noted that the legislature has carryover funds. And indeed, they do. So we found out that the legislature, the House and the Senate, have about $180 million total in what they're calling rainy day reserves. That is money that accrues from one year to the next that carries over if they don't spend it. It's unusual. There aren't a lot of areas in state spending where they're allowed to carry over the money, but the legislature does have this discretionary fund is what it's called.
So legislative leadership is coming to the rescue. They have that power, at least temporarily, to keep this money flowing, and they are tapping this reserve money. It almost sounded like they were questioning whether the governor did this on purpose or not.
You know, the legislature and the governor, they are very much in lockstep, as I wrote in my story, but they have said that it was an unintended consequence. He maintains he knew they had the money and they can go ahead and fund it. Let's just say there's no way he couldn't know what these vetoes would do.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, DeSantis made a lot of line item vetoes. He cut close to $1 billion total, including millions in cuts to arts funding. I mean, it does seem crazy that he wouldn't know what he's cutting.
No, I think they knew exactly what they were cutting for the legislative support services. They knew that the legislature had the money to fill in that gap. It is interesting that they cut so much money for, you know, the arts programs. What's a little frustrating, the past governors many times in their vetoes would include a letter or, you know, some kind of comments about their vetoes, telling the legislature his reasons for vetoing items. DeSantis does not do that. In fact, he rarely, when he vetoes a bill, he rarely gives insights into his rationale. He did recently on a controversial bill that would have basically really hamstrung the state's hemp manufacturers and retailers. But in these vetoes, in the budget vetoes, we didn't really get any insight, you know, so we don't know why he did this.
That was Derek Hamm with the News Service of Florida. WFSU asked the governor's office for comment about the vetoes and got no response. I'm Gina Jordan.
Governor DeSantis signed off on two bills bringing more services to Florida veterans. The new laws directly impact service members and their families. And as Adrian Andrews tells us, DeSantis says the measures will improve veteran benefits and create a military history program to preserve veteran stories.
DeSantis was in Pasco County for a bill signing ceremony.
Both of those.
The governor believes the legislation will bolster support for Florida's veterans and their families by expanding services like VA transition programs, giving preference to veteran spouses in VA nursing homes, and starting a new military history program. He says as part of his commitment in making Florida the, quote, most veteran-friendly state in the nation.
I think that once people know that they have these tools at their disposal, there's a lot that can be done at that point.
Part of the plans expand eligibility for admission to a veteran's long-term care facility. Currently in Florida, the Department of Veteran Affairs operates 9 such nursing homes and 1 domiciliary care facility for disabled vets. The bill updates the priority order of admissions to include the spouse of a qualifying veteran. However, spouses will be placed last in the admission priority list to ensure veterans get in before any non-veteran. James Hartsell, the executive director for the state's Veterans Affairs Department, supports the change.
This is the honorable thing to do, and it's the compassionate thing to do. And because of that, it's going to be well received by our veterans and every other citizen in our great state.
DeSantis was joined on stage by Jenny Stentiford, the daughter of a Florida Vietnam vet. She says the bill gives her mom, who's not a veteran, the chance to finally live with her husband of 61 years. Jenny's dad has been living in Land O' Lakes, Florida, at one of their VA facilities for the past 2 years.
My mom and dad are going to be able to live the rest of their lives together. And not only for our family, though it means so much, but all the other veterans and their spouses.
The second bill, House Bill 1329, brings more job and education opportunities to veterans. The state's nonprofit, Florida Is for Veterans, will handle military transition affairs for veterans and their spouses reaching the end of their service career. The governor is also awarding honorably disabled vets a free hunting and fishing license as long as they live in the state.
So there's a lot of opportunities, and we want to make sure that we're helping the veteran realize those opportunities, training programs, what have you.
The Florida legislature has implemented some education initiatives, such as requiring middle and high school students to learn about the history and importance of Veterans Day and Memorial Day. It also establishes the state's first Veterans History Program, which will record the stories of Florida's veterans.
I was with 2nd Field Forces Vietnam.
Joe West is the president of the Tallahassee chapter of Vietnam Veterans of America. During an interview with WFSU, he said he can recall how hot it was and the foul smell of burning trash. Nonetheless, he says the Vietnam War was a time when he met some of his closest friends and lifelong brothers.
You ask anybody that's won a Medal of Honor, and they're going to tell you they didn't do it for mom, apple pie, and America. They did it for the guy on the right and left side of them. That's why.
In order to preserve more of these stories, the Florida legislature has set aside $91,000 in the state budget to start the history program. The two veteran bills will go into effect on July 1st. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Governor DeSantis's Stop Woke Act is facing a court challenge.
It cuts off one side of the conversation based off of what ideas the state government does and doesn't agree with.
And we'll tag along with a Juneteenth observance that turned out to be a real learning experience.
Learning about my own state, which I barely knew anything about, it was an eye-opener.
Attorneys for the state and the American Civil Liberties Union battled it out in federal appeals court last week. The ACLU is fighting to keep in place an injunction placed on a 2022 Florida law the governor dubbed the Stop Woke Act. The law restricts how race-related concepts are taught in higher education. Before those arguments, WMNF's Megan Bowman spoke to ACLU of Florida staff attorney Jerry Edwards, who's representing the plaintiffs.
What are some of the main problems with laws such as this?
I would say that the main problems, there are really three of them. The first is that the law doesn't give fair warning of what it prohibits. It's written in such a way, to put it in legal terms, that it's unconstitutionally vague. The second is that the law discriminates based off of views. And what that means is that it cuts off one side of the conversation based off of what ideas the state government does and doesn't agree with. And in our professors, they are teaching based on what are the best standards in their academic discipline. They're teaching courses they have been told, you know, we want you to teach this course that involves discussions of race. But now the state has come in and said, well, yes, you could teach the course that involves these discussions of race, but only certain ideas that we like. And so that violates the First Amendment. The final is equal protection, and that is this law discriminates against Black professors and students by targeting ideas that they want to learn and that they disproportionately teach.
How really is Stop Woke Act violating the plaintiffs' First Amendment rights and their 14th Amendment rights?
So right now we have an injunction against the law. The court has prevented the state from enforcing the law while the lawsuit is moving forward. That is what's being argued, is whether that injunction should stay in place, whether the court came to the right conclusion. So right now the law can't be enforced, which I think is helping to allow these conversations to happen. While there may not be supervision or, you know, the state surveillance in every course, there's always that fear that it could happen, or that somebody could misunderstand something out of context, and that you could be punished for talking about something that is an accepted idea in your discipline, or playing devil's advocate during a discussion to get your students to think critically. And really what this law is trying to do is it's trying to take away that leeway that professors have been traditionally given under academic freedom and force them to, and this may sound crazy, but this is actually what the state said when the judge questioned them before the trial court. He asked, could the state, under your theory, come in and hand professors scripts and force them to read for it? And the state said, yes, we could hand them scripts and force them to read exactly what we want them to say. And so while this law may not go quite that far, they were opening the door to go that far in the future. The good news is the law was only in effect for about 5 months, and some of that was during the summer, so there wasn't a lot of teaching going on. So it didn't have the sort of impact it could have, but if this injunction goes away, the state will be able to enforce it again.
What is the best and the worst case, I guess, scenario?
This ruling, if they rule in our favor, will help our case in the lower court to get a permanent injunction, stopping the state from ever enforcing this law. And so it would be a very good outcome. And I think it'll also set a precedent nationwide that these sorts of laws are disfavored because they violate free speech. On the other hand, worst case scenario is if the court overturns and says that it's government speech. And what that will mean is if it is government speech, which is what the state is arguing, it'll mean the state has total authority to dictate what college professors can say in class.
That was ACLU of Florida staff attorney Jerry Edwards talking with WMNF's Megan Bowman about the lawsuit against the state over the Stop Woke Act. The case is pending an appeals court decision. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a new Florida law requiring mayors and other city officials to file a more rigorous form of financial disclosure this year than they have in the past. We get more on that story from Margie Menzel.
According to the judge, the law violates the First Amendment rights of elected municipal officials and candidates. Up until last year, city officials had only been responsible for filing a Form 1, a less rigorous form of disclosure. But the law in dispute brought them in line with the disclosures of legislators, cabinet members, county commissioners, district school board members, and other constitutional officers. It's called a Form 6. And under it, those state and constitutional officers have to specify their net worth, their assets and liabilities over $1,000, and itemize every source of income over $1,000. Passage of the law last year was followed by dozens of resignations by city officials statewide.
Could it be they had something they didn't want to have to disclose?
Ben Wilcox is the research director for Integrity Florida, a government watchdog that backed the law.
All the people that are subject to Form 6 financial disclosure now, you don't see anybody objecting to it or resigning their position because they have to disclose this information. And it's almost like they don't recognize why this disclosure is necessary.
It's necessary, Wilcox says, so that the public can be confident their public servants aren't benefiting personally from their public service. Caroline Clanke is the executive director of the Florida Ethics Institute, an independent nonprofit that supports the expansion of Form 6. She says many city officials have tremendous authority over large amounts of taxpayer dollars.
And for that reason, the Commission on Ethics has for years sought that city commissioners should also have the same amount of transparency as county commissioners.
But many city officials say their cities are so small that they don't get paid, and that the last thing they want is another reason for their volunteer officials to quit. Mindy Gibson serves on the City Council of Satellite Beach and spoke against the bill last year.
Most of the people that serve in their communities are volunteers. We don't get a salary, we don't get paid. And we're constantly sort of being presented that we're in some form of going to be creating some sort of ethical violation, and most of us are not.
Gibson, a small business owner, says these municipal volunteers are giving up time with their families in order to serve.
And I did speak to the woman from the Ethics Commission when she spoke at for the House bill, and I asked her, how many ethics violations would have not occurred had somebody filled out a Form 6 instead of a Form 1? And I was not able to be given an answer. And to me, that speaks that the Form 6 isn't going to stop ethics violations or create them.
Wilcox of Integrity Florida says he hopes someone will appeal the judge's decision.
I think the judge got it wrong in this case, but I'm not sure who that would be. but right now, I think city officials are not going to be held to that higher standard of full financial disclosure.
A staffer for the Senate bill sponsor, Jason Broder, says he'll be watching too. I'm Margie Menzel.
Legislation on Governor Ron DeSantis' desk could drastically change state and local ethics boards in Florida. Tristan Wood reports that it has ethics experts ringing alarm bells.
The bill adds time limits to the length of ethics investigations, requires sworn affidavits to launch complaints, and bans secondhand knowledge from being used in investigations. It also allows those running for public office to seek civil damages when someone files a fraudulent complaint. Many of those bill elements were added by Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess. He argued on the Senate floor that the changes were to keep ethics commissions from being used for political purposes.
Somebody could just call a tip line hotline, pick up the phone and say, hey, this person's doing X, Y, and Z, hang up the phone, and then immediately maybe call the media and tip that off that a complaint was made, and then the whole thing spirals out of control.
But ethics officials from around the state aren't buying it. Jose Arejo is the executive director of the Miami-Dade County Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, which oversees ethics complaints in the county and its 34 municipalities. Currently, the commission only receives about 50 sworn complaints a year, but receives hundreds of anonymous complaints through their tip line and other ways to protect whistleblowers. In a previous interview with WFSU, Arejo said the plan completely changes the scope of how his department can serve the public.
You know, I think the citizens of Miami-Dade County have lost a repository for complaints of ethical misconduct. You know, the one agency that could take these referrals and act upon them and, you know, send them out to different agencies, the ability to do that no longer exists for the citizens of Miami-Dade County, at least not with their ethics commission.
Amid complaints from ethics professionals, the bill has been defended by legislative leadership. A few weeks ago, Senate President Kathleen Pastodomo issued a written statement defending the legislation, saying critics of the bill are mischaracterizing it. She wrote that, quote, plenty of local ethics boards already require sworn complaints based on the standard in the bill, and I have concerns that in other jurisdictions the self-initiation powers are or could be politicized and weaponized. Ben Wilcox, research director for Integrity Florida, says those concerns are unfounded. He believes the measure is an attempt to prevent local boards from doing their jobs.
We already have a situation where for the commission, Florida Commission on Ethics, to even begin an investigation into, you know, possible unethical behavior, someone has to file a sworn complaint with the Florida Commission on Ethics before they can even begin an investigation. So this makes so that much harder for a person to file a complaint and have that complaint investigated.
DeSantis may choose to veto the bill. If he signs it or doesn't act on it, it will become law. Wilcox says it would be cowardly for the governor to not take a stance on it.
If he agrees that we want to weaken our ethics laws, then he should sign it. If he wants to continue to ensure that the Florida Commission on Ethics is able to enforce the ethics laws, then he should veto this bill.
The governor has until July 2nd to take action. I'm Tristan Wood.
Well, this is not just an election year when it comes to people, but it's also an election year when it comes to some pretty important issues. Because in November, voters are going to have the chance to decide here in Florida whether to enshrine the right to abortion in the state's constitution. Now, if they do, does that come with a price tag for taxpayers? Always an important question. So Regan McCarthy is here to talk with us about that. And implies the question is currently mired in a lawsuit, Regan. So again, thanks for coming on. But what's up with the lawsuit here?
Yeah, sure, Tom. Happy to be here. So let's start with a little bit of background, which is that any time a proposed amendment is put on the ballot through a citizens initiative process, then it has to go to this group of state employees called the Financial Impact Estimating Conference. And they craft this financial impact statement. And so they've done that, but people who support this proposed amendment are concerned that the financial impact estimating statement is, they call it, inaccurate, ambiguous, misleading, and unclear. And so earlier this month, they went to court and a Leon County judge agreed with them and he ordered the state estimators to write a new statement.
Well, what's the problem? What does the group say in their way of looking at it is ambiguous and misleading about the way that the wording is put together right now?
Yeah, so well, what happened is that the group of estimators wrote their statement back in November of 2023. And so that is before this year in April, the state Supreme Court ruled on Florida's 15-week abortion ban, which then triggered the current 6-week abortion ban that's in place now. And so the estimators had said that there was a lot of uncertainty about what might happen with the 15-week ban and the current 6-week ban. And so because of that uncertainty, they couldn't really say what that financial impact would be. Now, of course, that uncertainty has been cleared, and so supporters of the amendment say a new statement should be issued.
Okay, so where do we go from here? What's next?
So the judge ordered the estimators to go ahead and write a new statement, and they do have a meeting scheduled in July where they're expected to do that. But the state's pushing back on that ruling. They've actually filed an appeal, and they're saying that that appeal is moving forward because they don't think that the Leon County judge had the right to make that ruling, and that only the Supreme Court could make a ruling on whether something like this that should go on the ballot is accurate and good. Either way, though, experts say they are expecting the estimating conference to revisit this issue, and we'll see if they come out with a different statement.
Meanwhile, the clock keeps going tick, 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 and November gets ever closer. We know that you're going to be updating us on this as new developments happen. Thanks, Regan.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, it's been about a year since Florida endorsed new and controversial Black history standards. Since then, some efforts have been underway to find creative ways to learn Black history in public schools. Danielle Pryor took part in a recent Black history bus tour in the historic Central Florida town of Eatonville.
About 40 people joined the Juneteenth Central Florida Black History Bus Tour over the weekend. June 19, 1865 marks the day when the last enslaved people in the U.S. learned they were free. The goal of the bus tour was simple, to highlight important local history that most Floridians don't learn about in school.
I realized I actually was a fan of history. It just wasn't the history that was being taught to me.
13-year-old Caitlin Hurd was on the tour with her mom, Yolanda Powell.
I've always been like a history buff, a history geek. So learning about my own state, which I barely knew anything about, was an eye-opener.
Caitlin's entering eighth grade at Southwest Middle School in Palm Bay. She says she hasn't learned a lot of black history in school.
We just learned about the basic Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, stuff that happened years and years and years ago. Yeah. Never this. Never anything in Florida, really.
I caught up with the mother and daughter at the Eatonville stop of the tour. The township is the oldest black incorporated municipality in the U.S. The tour group had already visited Ocoee, the site of the 1920 massacre of black residents, and Washington Shores, one of the first black communities in Orlando. 74-year-old Charlotte Kendall was also on the tour. She says she was active in the civil rights movement of the 1960s and fears not teaching this history means it could be forgotten.
It's just so important to me to know history. And my dream is that someday it won't be black history. It'll just be history of all of us.
At a State Board of Education meeting last month, dozens of people spoke out against the state's black history standards that were up for reapproval.
I think we're missing an opportunity to correct historical inaccuracies, specifically descriptions of slavery, where it states slaves develop skills.
In the end, the board unanimously voted to keep in place black history standards that teach kids that, quote, slaves develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit. AP African American History is still banned in the state, and the Stop Woke Act limits how teachers can teach race and gender in K-12 classrooms. Eric Small works on DEI issues for Rollins College and is a professor of philosophy there. He says that going beyond what's taught in classrooms is critical. He himself has taught a class on African history at Agape Church in Orlando, but he says it's not the same as getting to take a class in school over a full semester.
So I enjoy what people are doing. I participated myself. I think it's excellent that they've stepped up. But I also think it's a shame that where the experts are in the classrooms, the knowledge can't be delivered to students there.
Under Florida statute, schools are required to teach black history. What people have had concerns about is to what degree. Back on the tour, husband and wife Robert and Anna Beck say nothing should be left out when teaching black history. They don't want any instruction around any history restricted.
Of course we should know about each other. I don't want my children and grandchildren not to know as much as they can.
As they get ready to head to Paramore, the next stop on their tour, Anna says she hates that we're still having this conversation around whether black history should be taught in full in 2024.
We should be progressing, not regressing. But I love the state. I love the beauty. I love Florida. I'm so glad we moved here. But that piece needs some work.
In Orlando, I'm Danielle Pryor.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Megan Bowman and Danielle Pryor. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.